we are not in these systems kind of one against the system. There are all kinds of ways in which we are also aggregated into data sets, data profiles. We are, our data lives in relationship to other kinds of people and ideas. And the data about us is bought and sold and traded, you know, every day. I mean, when Cambridge Analytica broke, everyone was, you know, like horrified. And I thought, well, the whole business model of the internet, of the commercial internet, is Cambridge Analytica. There's thousands of Cambridge Analyticas. Like, that's what they're doing, is buying, selling, trading information about us.
Voices of the Data Economy, a podcast supported by Ocean Protocol Foundation. We bring to you the voices shaping the data economy and challenging it at the same time. We talk about breaking down data silos and equalizing access to data for all.
Hello and welcome. Today we have a very special guest with us, Safia Noble. She's the author of Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. And she's also the associate professor at University of California, Los Angeles, in the Department of Information Studies. Hello, Safia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. So it's morning for you there.
It is. It is morning. Indeed.
And is this the first thing you're doing?
This is the first thing I'm doing alongside drinking a cup of coffee, which I probably wouldn't be able to get any words out right now had I not made this morning. So that's what's happening. But I'm excited to be here with you.
Yeah, and I'm more than excited. So thank you so much for taking out time. Your book, by the way, a great one, Algorithms of Oppression, and I think it is a topic that makes sense right now more than any other time. And I think this is what we feel always about this topic. You know, we feel that, oh, it's making sense right now more than any other time. And just to give a little bit of context to our audience, it primarily talks about the fact that the internet is not an unbiased place, specifically search engines. And as millennials or professionals or we, even students, you know, who are doing everyday work and living normal lives, we really rely on the world of internet and search engines for all sort of validation of information. And also from your background, I understand that you were first in the advertising tech space and you spent a substantial time there and then moved to academics and research. So just to start with, if you could give a little bit of background on your relationship with search engines and how from ad tech you are now questioning them.
Sure. Well, it's a really great assessment there that you've given. And I will say that when I was writing this book, you know, I guess I should say before it became a book, when it was a dissertation, and all through writing it, every year that it took, I kept thinking, this is the moment for this book. This is the moment. The moment is going to pass us by, that this book needs to be out and available. And yet here we are in 2021. And the concerns that I write about and that I've documented in that book are still just as timely as they were, you know, 7 years ago, 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it is an interesting experience to write something that remains timely because the problems have become more acute each year. So, you know, how I came to this study and to care about these things really was not a kind of typical straight line. I am a late stage, let's say second career academic. My first career, I spent 15 years in corporate America, working with a variety of kind of Fortune 50 companies in the United States. I ultimately ended up working directly in an advertising agency and a couple of different ad agencies. And one of the things that we were doing as I was kind of coming to the close of the time I would spend in that business was thinking about search engines and how we could, you know, game them, optimize mm-hmm. our clients' content, and make sure that it showed up on the first page, because we were so acutely aware that search engines were advertising platforms, and we could, you know, help our clients purchase their way to the top, or we could make sure that we, for example, presented their products and services or events or public relations activity as editorial mm-hmm. and have it kind of presented like news. So, you know, I was very involved in kind of thinking about that in the early days of people's, you know, increasing reliance upon search engines. And as people were moving, and of course, by the time I left the advertising industry, we had moved significant portions of our advertising and kind of media buying dollars away from traditional media, like out of home. You know, this is billboards, bus stops, subways, television, radio, newspaper in particular, and had, you know, print, magazines, and was moving it. We were moving those dollars to kind of online advertising. So as I kind of left that industry, you know, the recession hit, everything was collapsing. Our work was collapsing in advertising. My friends were all losing their jobs too. It was really a bleak time. And that's when I decided to go back to graduate school. And it was shocking, quite frankly, to see that the conversations about search engines at the time I entered graduate school were quite different than the way we thought of search engines in corporate. And this really, I thought, was kind of an opening. I was trying to search around and explore for a way to talk about these differences and maybe what's at stake when the public thinks of something like a search engine as you know, an information or knowledge portal, but you know, everybody else who's spending money on the platforms understand them to be advertising engines.
Okay, so what were the main differences that you saw in how the two worlds were looking at search engines particularly? And I would rather actually put it in this way, that how do algorithms actually become algorithms of oppression?
Well, one of the things that was different and that is, I think, less maybe easy to apprehend about these systems is that, first of all, the early days of kind of internet information organization was, you know, kind of before we had search engines, we had what we called virtual libraries. So this kind of web 1.0, if you will, kind of early web knowledge and expertise organization was mostly managed by subject matter experts, by librarians, by people who were deeply knowledgeable, who would go in and, you know, organize, you know, very complex libraries. If anyone remembers the days of being on the internet before a search engine, you know that it was a clunkier, let's just say it required time and energy to look through and sort and figure out and discern what was legitimate and what wasn't, and looking to the source of where that information came from. And those things were much, much more transparent because you truly were going through a variety of different kinds of sites and sites of expertise. And I think the legacy of that early history of knowledge organization, information organization on the web, really kind of search engines inherited the trust from those early experts who were doing that kind of work. And so what that meant was when the kind of instant result production happened, right? You go to a white blank page, there's just a box, you put in terms that you're looking for, of course, this is the case of Google, and boom, you've got all these results. And the assumptions, I think, for a lot of people is that somebody's curating the expert knowledge here. Somebody has decided what should be ranked first and what should be ranked, you know, a million. And so those kind of legacy ways of library and information professionals and other kinds of experts was deeply, I think, trusted. So as I was going into graduate school, for example, librarians and other kinds of information workers and experts were excited about search and thinking about what search could do to kind of for a user experience, right? Or a patron or somebody looking for knowledge and information could find it so much more quickly because we remembered what it was like before that. Okay, so at an algorithmic level, kind of what's happening here is, you know, what we can't see is that there's kind of a whole, you know, project and a product of Google called AdWords that's really looking to optimize or take advantage of the optimization of content, if you will, and match it to the kinds of keywords that get put in on that front end user interface. So what you see here is a largely invisible process for the public. A lot of assumptions that I think were made in the early days of search engines by librarians. And of course, my field, I come out of the field of library and information science. So that's why I'm particularly interested. Kind of maybe giving more trust than they should be. The advertising model, not at all being apparent. You can't see it on the front page. There's no way to see that kind of the computational logics are about helping Google make money in its real-time auction where you can, you know, those who pay the most can optimize their content in their search platform. So these are kind of the things that were super interesting. They remain incredibly interesting to me because now we're a whole generation into using the internet, maybe two, that completely trust what they find in search engines. They have a lot of assumptions about the reliability and efficacy of what they find in a search engine. And we're talking about judges, lawyers, all kind, you know, college admissions officers who are doing searches on people, employers who are searching on potential candidates to see if there's anything that comes up. And of course, we have people who are also trying to fight the disinformation, patently false information that exists on the internet about them. So it's a very different environment than the early days of the internet. And I think these are things that are incredibly important because what we find in search engines has such a profound effect on behavior and actions in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a line in your book which says that Google search is in fact an advertising platform not intended to solely serve as a public information resource in the way that, say, a library might. Google creates advertising algorithms and not information algorithms. And I think that right now the problem is that these companies don't own up to this fact, you know, and that's what creates a lot of problems, and it's manipulating the minds of people. And how do you think it's actually affecting? We all know it's affecting the actions that are happening in the world today, you know, all extreme this political rage and the opinions of people. But how do you think this whole thing actually works and affects the minds of people and manipulates it?
Well, you know, in fairness to those who do this kind of work, and, you know, when you talk to experts about their area of expertise, most of us are, let's say, reticent to speak too much into areas that we don't directly research. So I feel a little bit slow to, you know, kind of opine on the neurological and psychological dimensions of the effects of this kind of these kinds of processes on human beings. But I will say that we have plenty of research, for example, and this is one of the things I kind of try to focus on in the book about let's say, exposure to stereotypes, to racial stereotypes, to racist stereotypes, will can affect the way that people see those groups. So if you live in a society where there is a lot of kind of gross racist stereotyping, people will become desensitized to the groups that are being stereotyped, and those groups will be subject to, you know, not only dehumanizing images and ideas, but they also will be then subject to more harms because the public is desensitized to their humanity. So we know a lot of research about media stereotypes, and this is, of course, one of the reasons why in other media, like film and television, let's say, there has been a tremendous amount of effort around the world, especially in the United States, in Hollywood, to eradicate racist stereotypes and sexist stereotypes, and to increase the representation of minoritized, let's say, ethnic and racial minorities, and positive images of women and LGBTQ people. So we know that there's been active organizing, right, for 50 years at least on this, because what happens is, in the absence of that kind of resistance and organizing against stereotypes, people relate to what they see as truthful. They relate to the stereotypes as truthful because they may never have contact or intimate relationships or friendships with those groups. So when I looked at that research and I said, well, you know, of course, this can only be even more profound in terms of the internet, because people think of the internet. And of course, we have great studies by my colleagues at like the Pew Research studies on search engine users and their use that tell us that people strongly believe in the reliability and credibility of what they find in a search engine. Now, that's very different than believing in the reliability and credibility of a Hollywood film. So I think these are the reasons, right, that we have to be concerned, because Google is an advertising platform. People think that it's a fact checker. And in this particular moment where there's been an incredible amount of attention on social media and, you know, propaganda that moves through, and racism and very harmful ideas that move through social media, people are much more attuned to that. they are not paying attention, I don't think sufficiently, to how people will then turn to Google to fact check things that they find in social media that might be off, and then use Google as the kind of an authoritative yes or no. So if you have Google also rife with racist disinformation and propaganda, sexist propaganda, well, that's incredibly unhelpful. And I think it increasingly has consequences in the world.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's kind of scary, actually. You know, and talking of particular examples, which ones do you think are the most misrepresented searches as of today? Why I particularly ask this is because in your book you mention about what happened when you searched black girls at that point of time and then the kind of results you got. But today that has improved significantly in terms of when I search black girls, I get, say, Black Girls Code or the latest article on the black community. But it's nothing really offensive that I would get in the first page. So things changed. And now how would I know that which are the most misrepresented searches where is the most sensitive area right now?
It's such a great question. And one of the things that I try to remind people is that, you know, first of all, people who write books and journalists who write articles about large internet companies are kind of like opening a ticket. This is like a term that we use in, especially in, you know, tech companies where you need to fix something, or in a, you know, in a, like a tech ecosystem, you open a ticket, and this is like a way that you get a signal that, someone needs to attend to this problem. and solve it and close the ticket. So in many ways, I think of my book as like a giant book of tickets that Google was able to take. And, you know, I certainly noticed that they attended to many of the concerns that I both document in that book, but also that many of my colleagues and journalists and scholars have put out there. So one thing that that tells us is that even though the leadership of Google will say, and the founders of Google will say, we don't, you know, do anything to affect the search results, indeed, we know that they absolutely do. And the deeper the public relations fiasco, or the kind of the hotter the temperature is for them, the more likely they are to change the results. So one of the things that I, you know, encourage people to do is, you know, look at what the criticisms have been over, let's say, the last 10 years, and whether those problems remain. And that will tell you a lot about the dynamic way in which the company is constantly, constantly shifting search results based on a political environment, based on criticism, based on who's paying the most. So that's a data point, right? That's an interesting inquiry. You know, in terms of ongoingly, I mean, in the United States, I can tell you that, you know, if you search for Latina girls, Asian girls, you're going to be met with a lot of hypersexualized and kind of pornified content. Google auto suggestion, you know, it's interesting, people still to this day will tweet at me egregious results that they find on Twitter. So, you know, that includes like the auto suggestions that Google is offering. Just this week, I saw someone tweeted at me, you know, we had, of course, the world has witnessed this racist insurrection here in the United States in an attempt to throw over the United States government. By a, you know, mob of white nationalists, Trump supporters. And someone tweeted at me that when they typed in Civil War, for example, that Google was auto-completing, you know, things like, and ideas like, is inevitable, is coming, right, is here. So, you know, this is very interesting because, of course, many of us are trying to make sense of the intensity of this kind of white nationalist mobilization. These ideas, of course, have been, you know, in the United States since its inception, but there is certainly a very well-organized mobilization of that sentiment, anti-Black, racist, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim sentiment. So, you know, when people are going to make sense of this moment and the reporting and the coverage, it's interesting, I think, and in fact, harmful to type in something like Civil War and then have Google suggest that it's imminent, as if we have no agency, as if we have no way to frame what's happening, except as, you know, a fait accompli of, you know, a devastating war, for example. And I think, you know, we could even challenge the notion of, is this a war in the traditional sense of like the United States military being mobilized, which of course happened in our first Civil War in the United States. So these ways of, it's not so much like the it's a dynamic, let's just say, environment search is, and people are very actively invested in manipulating it as a media environment, as they would other kinds of media environments. And of course, you know, the work of my colleague, Joan Donovan at Harvard at the Shorenstein Center, who studies media manipulation and the way, for example, white nationalists seek to manipulate the media into amplifying their messages by, you know, reporting on it as news, is important. And I think when Google and YouTube and, you know, its companies are, the companies of Alphabet are shaping the discourse, what happens again is people are coming and they're relating to that discourse as fact just by virtue of the fact that it's happening in a search engine. It's not happening on a website. It's happening in the search engine. So the assumptions and the logics behind it are that people can trust because Google's done its homework to vet what's important and, what's trash and disinformation propaganda and what's not. And this is, I think, incredibly dangerous to have, because of course Google's making an incredible amount of money off of that kind of propaganda. It's the propaganda that's going viral.
Yeah. I mean, when I hear these stories, I feel like these people are the most powerful people in the world, you know, who are controlling the algorithms to actually change my opinion about something, or rather form my opinion about something. And then, you know, comes the question of power dynamics between the government and the biggest tech companies in the world. And I know in our previous conversation that we had, we spoke briefly about regulations, and you had an opinion that somewhat regulations can change the scenario. I mean, in Europe, we have the GDPR, and it's been a year or two of GDPR. We also did an episode on the fact that how is that actually helping us in controlling our own data. But how, my question to you is that, why do you think government regulation can solve this, and how? How does it change the power dynamics?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot here to unpack because so let me try to just quickly nuance the challenges here around regulation. First of all, many of these U.S. companies have been funded and really heavily supported by the U.S. government. And this includes companies that are like household brand names like Google and Facebook, to companies, let's say, that might be less well understood by the public, you know, like Palantir or other kinds of surveillance technology companies. So, which of course Facebook and Google both are too. So when you talk about a regulatory environment, one of the challenges is that governments, especially the United States government, has a kind of unique relationship to many companies in the tech sector, because they are able to access hundreds of millions of Americans' data and information, because they kind of have an open back door, right? They can come in, law enforcement and other kinds of agencies can come in and find out all kinds of information about people, let's say about what people do on the internet. That might be a more accurate way to describe it, because I don't think that everything we do on the internet is actually knowing about us as people. But let's say you can understand what people are doing on the internet. And so this when we talk about regulation and privacy and these conversations, it's very hard to apprehend how the state will respond to shutting down, or let's say closing its back door into this kind of information about the public. It has a vested interest in knowing that. It also uses that. I mean, we have seen, for example, now democracy is being threatened with the rise of authoritarian governments or right-wing and fascist governments, certainly fascist-leaning governments in democracies, because of their ability to access and manipulate so much information on the public's, right, where those movements are afoot. So, you know, this is one of the reasons why I think regulation is very challenging, because the government would also, in essence, if there were, let's say, certain types of protections for the public put in place, that would also potentially protect the public from the state's ability to know things. So, okay, we have like one kind of set of challenges in that area. We also have, I think, a conception of, I'll say, like in the case of Google and these kinds of companies, this notion that consumer privacy is very individual, and it lives kind of at the unit of yourself against these systems. And so privacy gets treated as like a property right that one has. Your data is your property. You have property rights. Property rights is a kind of prevailing legal model in the United States and in many other places. So this makes it also a challenge because we are not in these systems kind of one against the system. There are all kinds of ways in which we are also aggregated into data sets, data profiles. Our data lives in relationship to other kinds of people and ideas. And the data about us is bought and sold and traded, you know, every day. I mean, when Cambridge Analytica broke, everyone was, you know, like horrified. And I thought, well, the whole business model of the internet, of the commercial internet, is Cambridge Analytica. There's thousands of Cambridge Analyticas. Like, that's what they're doing, is buying, selling, trading information about us and building data profiles. Now, what we don't have access to are the thousands, you know, dare I say, kind of infinite number of data profiles that might exist about us in any given system and any given moment in, you know, thousands and thousands of companies. And I think this then becomes a really difficult thing to regulate. How do you call back all that data? Is it even possible? What are we talking about? So in some ways, I feel like it's a bit of a smoke and mirrors here. To satisfy public outrage about the way these systems are tracking and profiling us and overdetermining our futures in many cases, right? They're creating predictions about us, whether we should go to jail, stay in jail, whether we should get health care, whether we should get a vaccine or not, whether we should get into college or university, whether we should get a job, whether our resume should be seen, right, by an HR manager. There's so many places now where predictive analytics are being used on information about us. And I think this is, to talk about privacy in that, in the way that our data is truly being used by so many systems is really, I think, again, it's like a little bit of a regulatory environment to quell the outrage while the public is not as knowledgeable as we need to be and as, of course, as we eventually will be. It's a complex environment. The only other thing I'll say is, there's a tremendous amount of effort, of course, by governments to think about regulating the use of AI. We could think of many of these platforms as being kind of narrow AI, right? This is difficult because all of those governments are also deeply invested in using AI. So, I don't know how we're going to solve it. Of course, I think that, civil rights and human rights framings and laws are very, very important. I think one of the places we will have an incredible amount of power in various publics is through civil and human rights and sovereign rights laws and legal protections, damages that have to be paid by companies to the public and to individuals, repair and restoration that must be made for example, the role that the tech sector has played in collapsing many important social institutions, public institutions, just by virtue of their not paying taxes or their offshoring profits. So I think those are exciting places to look at legal repair and restoration, damages and harm, rights. I think that that's a little bit of a different domain than just the domain of privacy and things like GDPR. It's just a different way to cut in on regulation.
Yeah. And it's also like a deeply discussed topic, because by the end of it, somebody is going to have the power and we just need to decide who. And actually, I want to ask you this. There's an entire wave of young entrepreneurs and the investor community who talk about decentralization a lot. And I think Naval Ravikant, also from AngelList, tweeted yesterday that the first generation of internet was partially decentralized and built upon stateless open web protocols. And the second generation of internet will be fully decentralized and built on stateful open web protocols, aka public blockchains. But when I talk to people outside this bubble, I see like it seems like a very far-fetched vision to people. Now, you are in the academic world and you also talk to corporates and companies and tech companies a lot. What is your sense in terms of how far this place is where everything is going to be decentralized and we'll be able to own our data, sell our data? Like, do people even think about that as an option outside?
Yeah, this is a really interesting idea. And, you know, I have to say that I live in, you know, multiple worlds. So kind of professionally, yes, I do spend quite a bit of time with people who work in industry and who, and, you know, people who are thinking, techno enthusiasts, let's say, technologists of different stripes. And I think there exists this kind of nirvana state of, you know, a technological fantasy about how we're kind of going to work it out technically, right? We're going to work it out with different kinds of systems design. We're going to work it out with less surveillance, with, you know, masking. this is a narrow community of people relative to the world. I mean, I also exist kind of in my family and in my community where everyone's just trying to figure out how to keep their job in the midst of COVID-19, not get sick, to care for parents and children at the same time. I mean, I'm so classically Gen X kind of in that sandwich space myself. And I think that if you look out, the majority of the world is not in a position to have the luxury of thinking about technical redesign. But these technologies will continue to get beta tested and practiced out on us. And so I think this is where I struggle with the notion that there will be some type of new, you know, decentralized technology. I mean, the issue of even the kind of fantasy that we have had, that the early internet was a borderless, you know, cyber utopian space, is just, you know, I think the early internet scholars, people like Lisa Nakamura and Wendy Chun and Anna Everett, you know, these women of color, really taught us about the materiality of the internet, where it was located, how it was designed. And it was certainly not frictionless. It was full of kind of racial and racist logics. And their early work is still so relevant and important today. So I guess I don't think there's going to be a, you know, a utopian better way. I think what we are seeing is more technology, more data than ever, than you know, in human history. And we have more global inequality, economic and social inequality to go with it. So to me, the question is, to what degree are these technologies going to be used in undoing inequality? To what degree will these technologies be able to redistribute wealth and the largesse of the kind of collective productivity of humankind? You know, we see studies, for example, that show us that by the year 2030, the top 1% will own 2/3 of the world's wealth. Well, I think about, you know, who's in that 99%. Yeah, some of them are technologists who are dreaming about a better technology, but everybody else is going to be trying to figure out how to keep a roof over their head, which of course we see in all the cities, how to get food, how to have access to clean water, how to have the environments we live in not collapse. Those are actually the things that matter to me. And I don't see where the technology community is necessarily putting these ideas in service of these kinds of gross distributions. Instead, what they're doing is making technologies that are actually enhancing the extraction and the exploitation of people who will not be in a position to resist, who have no idea what they're working on, who probably don't even care and are just trying to figure out how to survive. And that troubles me. That's the kind of thing that keeps me up at night.
You know, it's very interesting that you talk about this, and probably we should look at an episode where we, because there are definitely some nice guys who talk about this as well, you know, how to make everybody rich, not rich, but rather how not to have poor people eventually, and how technology or decentralization can solve that. And they are not able to probably see the other side. And if we can have like a discussion between you two, I think that would make for a very interesting conversation to have on both the sides. So that's a podcast idea for me as well as we speak. And okay, now I'm going to go back to, I listened to one of your recordings with, I think, Nike, and where you were talking, where they invited you to talk on this topic. And it seems that the corporate world or the consumer sector particularly is getting more and more conscious about how they are, or at least talking about the fact that how they are using consumer data at this point. And if they are getting concerned about this and they are inviting you and they are talking to specialists, what is it that is actually their biggest challenge in, you know, protecting data of their consumers? Or are they too far that they cannot stop? So I just want to understand, like, what's the dynamics? Like, what's stopping them from taking the right steps? I mean, of course, one is profits, but what is the situation right now?
Yeah, it's such an interesting moment, because 2020, with the murder, the reckless, devastating murder of George Floyd, and all of the Breonna Taylor and so many Black people in the United States who were murdered by the state or by white citizens empowered by the state, really brought about a kind of an opening where I saw many, many Black scholars, me and many of my colleagues, being invited to come in to corporate America and talk about race. And of course, in the tech sector, or in kind of data intensive sectors, those of us who talk at the intersection of race and technology were invited into these spaces to talk about our work. And so I think there's a kind of a couple of things that have been happening. One, I think corporate America has been trying to grapple with the fact that they have been largely silent in the face of the murders of African Americans, largely silent on the civil rights movement that is Black Lives Matter, largely silent in speaking out about racist violence and the incredibly kind of bifurcated racist society that we live in the United States. So there's been a lot of pressure on companies by the people who work in those companies, by the employees who are like, what are we doing? Are we on the wrong side of history? And of course, these are many times Gen X and millennial aged employees who are like, not on my watch. I don't want to be on the wrong side of history. Who are out in the streets in a protest on the weekend and then go back to work and no one's talking about injustice and they're not having that. And so in many ways, I think, I've been invited into certain places at this particular moment in history where people are trying to figure out, as individuals in these companies, what can they do? So that is an interesting place, of course, of like awareness building and education. And I think many professors in particular, we take probably 90% or as many as we are humanly capable of doing. We take all the invitations to speak, because ultimately we're educators and we try to do education in all kinds of environments. And that's really kind of how I relate to my own work. I think that, you know, in the tech companies and the data intensive companies, yes, they're thinking about data. And again, this is like might be at the level of data scientists or marketing people, people who are doing, you know, consumer research and are thinking, wow, we have all this data. We, you know, we never thought about bias in our data. We never thought about how our data might get used in nefarious ways. We want to know more. We want to learn more. But that actually is very different than, let's say, the stance of a company in the market on Wall Street, right? Of its shareholders, of its board of directors, of its C-suite. That, I think, is a place when we think about what are companies doing, where are they invested in, and where are they divesting, and where are they turning new directions. Those things happen in those meetings. Most of us are not in those meetings. You know, when I think of something like, you know, a company like Nike or a company like, you know, insert any company, what employees are thinking about and what they care about and where they're trying to do the right thing in their jobs, I think is often very, very different than the executive decisions that get made about what a company is really doing or what its stance is. And this probably is never more acute than at a company, let's say, like Google or Facebook, where you have so many mid-level employees who are walking out, who are striking, who are trying to unionize or unionize now, who are protesting their employer. Those people are the people who typically are inviting in people like me to come and do education. Those are also people who put a lot on the line professionally in many cases. To try to get the companies that they work for to do the right things. And they are increasingly putting more and more on the line. And yet they are often overridden, fired, retaliated against by, you know, senior management in those companies. So it's just, what it shows us is that we have to have a complex understanding of all kinds of organizations and institutions, even in these companies. And I think that it will be tech workers themselves, as they continue to organize, who will have a tremendous amount of power, just like in other industries, when workers organize and unionize and work together to push back and don't put their labor in service of certain types of dangerous work in the world, things can change. And they have a lot of power. And so those are usually people that I'm trying to talk to and encourage, quite frankly, to see what they see and tell the public and share with the public what is harmful. And of course, this, you know, I think about my colleague, Dr. Timit Gebru, the chief kind of Google AI ethicist who was recently fired from Google. This is like an amazing Black woman, one of the only Black women senior tech ethicists in the United States at the biggest company. And when she points out how Google's you know, natural language processing technology can discriminate and create harm, she's fired. And, you know, of course, she had to endure an incredibly hostile workplace prior to that. And she stayed and did that work in the face of, I think, personal and professional abuse and harm, because she knew that if she wasn't there, it would be so much worse. And she knew she was there thinking about all the people who could potentially be harmed. And was, and so I think what we see is many of us work in and endure abuse in our workplaces, professors included, especially people of color and especially women, Black women. You know, I think of us in particular enduring an incredible amount of stress to do this type of work. And yes, we are interested in influencing what happens in these companies for the good of the public.
Yeah. No, and you're not the first person who's telling me that because, I mean, the same is with the topic of diversity and inclusion, you know. And you see mostly the people who are driving it in companies are the people who are black or people of color or, you know, from marginalized groups. So it's and probably they are the ones in the group also giving. I mean, I wish I could give specific examples, but I completely understand what you're talking about. So I get that sense. But anyway, there's a start. So, I mean, we are talking about it. So, Sophia, if you had to give an advice to younger people today to make the right decisions, because I don't know, I'm not talking to as many students as of today, but I remember when I was a student, these were dream jobs, you know, Google, tech companies, or these companies where people really wanted to work by the end of it. And if you had to give one advice to younger people on how to make the right decision, what would you say? I don't know how they are thinking right now, so maybe you could also tell me what is your experience with students and
I mean, that is such an interesting question. I love it. I'm smiling. You can't see me, but I'm smiling listening to you ask it because I'm thinking over the last decade, you know, when I was a teaching assistant, a TA in grad school, teaching undergraduates about these topics, right? As I was working on my dissertation. And I was showing them examples of the ways in which technologies were designed, let's say, with a kind of idealized, within a white imaginary, right, for, you know, light-skinned people, you know, I mean, from like sensors that fail to recognize dark skin, you know, all the kind of different examples that I would give that, of course, we all know about, right, from the racist soap dispenser to the, you know, the cameras that can't recognize, you know, people with, you know, Asian phenotype, right, and all kinds of different ways in which we were, you know, collecting evidence. Students a decade ago, undergraduates were, you know, they would sit with their arms crossed, really mad. They were just really mad. They were frustrated. Of course, that they aspired to go and work in these companies. And that was, you know, the dream was to get a job at a place like Google. So, you know, you can imagine how wildly unpopular I might have been as an instructor teaching about the harms of the tech industry. And, you know, now, I mean, fast forward a decade, I'm at UCLA and I'm teaching this quarter a class on data ethics and society. And the students' assumptions right out of the gate in the week one blow my mind. I mean, they're like, yeah, we know. We know these tech companies are trash. I mean, that's literally how they're oriented. They're how they speak. And it's just shocking to me to see this shift over 10 years. You know, every year I'm teaching, I've never had a break in teaching since I was a grad student. And so I see students every year and teach them, and they're very differently oriented around these technologies. Well, of course, you know, I know this is because of the work that so many of us have done to raise awareness, right? And that many of our ideas are mainstream ideas now. I mean, I can remember, I'll tell you, when I was writing my dissertation and I was trying to argue that technologies could discriminate at the level of code, do you know, it was very, very difficult to find four people who would be on a dissertation committee and agree with that. Most of my professors were like, that's impossible because code is just math and math cannot discriminate. It can't be racist. And so I finding the four people who would give me a PhD based on this argument was a challenge. And I will tell you that now this is, I mean, I'm at the airport, I can be anywhere, and people will tell me about, oh yeah, you know, these racist technologies. And I just chuckle because I think, you know, I'm sure it's like, you know, songwriters who write a song and it becomes a hit. And everyone's like, this is my jam. And you're like, yeah, I know, I wrote it. So it's like, I'm sure that there are, you know, people in the world, many of us who write books and who, you know, journalists and activists and organizers who are like, right, I know, I worked on that. I worked really, really hard to make this a common sense kind of understanding so that we could intervene upon it. And so students are very, very aware now, and they are energized about other spaces. They're very clear that if they're almost like the rebel forces who want to train to go in, you know, to the Death Star and, you know, work from the inside out to change it. They're sober about the issues that, you know, we've been talking about, this morning. So I think that is incredibly exciting to me to see what they already know. And that you got to remember, this is a generation for whom education is increasingly slipping away from them because it's so expensive to get a college degree now. These are young people who can't even imagine buying homes, living the way that their parents or grandparents lived, who feel devastated by the generations before them that have trashed the environment and left them with a planet that's, you know, on fire, full of mudslides. I mean, here we're in California, so, you know, it's like our state's on fire half of the year. So they're very aware and attuned to the state of the world and their precarity in it, even as Angelenos. And they see the incredible wealth inequality in a city like LA, where you can have $100 million homes and an encampment of people experiencing homelessness a mile down the road. I mean, it's devastating when you live and work in an environment like Los Angeles. You know, there's no way you can't see that the wrongness and the immorality of how we've organized our society. So I think that they're smart and they're on point and they're going to save the world. My colleagues and I laugh all the time that we're just like, oh, you know, thank God the young people are here. We're saved. Do you know? I mean, we really feel that. And we just like wish that we could get the generation before us, the baby boomers, to let go, to retire and relinquish power. So that the rest of us can try to salvage and fix many of the things that, and systems that are broken. So I feel incredibly energized and hopeful, even though I feel like, you know, we've been a lot, it's a doom and gloom kind of area that I study. I feel energized, and I mostly feel energized by younger people. And so I would say, like, keep doing what you're doing. I don't have any advice. I mean, what's your advice? I would say read and study and know. Get your knowledge in order. Don't be, you know, organizing on the fly, you know, kind of from the armchair where you don't have any political theory of change, and be clear on, you know, what you want to change and how you want to change it and work together. And, you know, this is indeed how centuries of people before us have affected change. It doesn't take everybody. It just takes the abolitionists, you know, it just takes the people who are organized and know how to interrogate the immorality of a society and force it to become just. And this is how we've seen civil rights and the abolition of the slave trade, you know, transatlantic slave trade. And, you know, I'm Black. I come from this legacy and this tradition. So I think in these terms. And so, you know, I hope that you know, all of us will, you know, remember, it doesn't take all of us. It just takes enough of us to be and make the change we want to see in the world.
Wow, that's such a positive note. Yeah, no, that's very inspiring. And I'm really happy to hear that as well. I think, I mean, you said advice, like, I don't know, personally, what worked for me was that I was never very afraid of asking too many questions. I mean, speaks of the fact that I'm a journalist, but you know, that doesn't work very well in companies when you end up asking too many questions on why we are doing this, why we are doing this. So yes, I think that's something that works. And as long as people are asking the right questions all the time, not the right questions, but they're just asking questions and not following what is being told to them blindly is where the, you know, change happens. And yeah, so wow.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, I'm so grateful for, you know, your work and your colleagues and the work of investigative journalists and journalists who are asking the questions. You know, we are seeing so many threats to the notion of democracy. Democracy hasn't even been fully realized for so many people in the world. I mean, even in the United States, so many of us, you know, live under two-tiered systems of justice, you know, systems of inequality that are naturalized and made normal. We need journalists who are constantly probing and asking the questions and making the space and creating the provocations. And journalists have really been under threat in democracies around the world. And so, you know, I just want you to know how much I honor the work that you do professionally. And I see it as being in tandem and in partnership with educators and scholars, researchers. I mean, our job is to illuminate the facts and the knowledge and to work with artists, right, to inspire the change and to, you know, show the harshness. And, you know, hopefully that gives rise to, again, positive change. So, you know, we're in this together. And I would just say, you know, I really appreciate you just giving me space to share about my work and share some thoughts. And I hope that it has a, you know, positive effect, you know, for your listener base too.
Oh my God, Sophia, you're the kindest. Thank you. I don't think anybody said that before in our podcast. So thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And it's a symbiotic relationship. And I mean, great to talk to you and also see how much impact the book has already brought in. In terms of when we do Google searches for something, so very lucky to see impact right away of your work. And do you want to tell us, I mean, probably the last thing that we are discussing today is what's your next research and do we see another book coming up soon?
Well, you know, most of my effort this year has been, you know, in 2020 and now in 2021 is around working with my colleague, Sarah Roberts, who wrote a very important book called Behind the Screen and the Shadows of Social Media. And she studies commercial content moderators and the kind of hidden labor of content moderation. And it's just, her work is very important. She and I have been building a new center at UCLA, the UCLA Center for Critical Internet Inquiry. It's a bit of an outpost of a place where people who are doing kind of work, asking the kinds of questions about power and inequality, and justice in the tech sector can you know, partner with us or, you know, think with us, study with us. So we've been really working hard on that. Of course, we're facing incredible austerity measures at UCLA because of COVID-19 and just the devastating effect that the disease has had on education and on, you know, budgets. And so we're just trying to kind of keep ourselves in existence and our staff and our team. And that's a big effort because I think we need these spaces and places to gather and convene and think and intervene and have impact together. Sarah and I are trying to write a book together that would be focused a little bit more on, you know, a public audience and less of an academic audience. So stay tuned for that. We're ruminating on what that will look like. I'll tell you, my real dream right now is to try and turn the book Algorithms of Oppression into art that can be taken up and kind of apprehended. So, you know, books, academic books aren't for everybody, but I think there's some really important people and ideas and concepts that we could translate through other kind of mass media, whether it's like film or television shows or those kinds of things. So, you know, my dream would be to see some of that go into production in 2021 and have the ability to kind of storytell more about these kinds of things, right? In ways that are with sympathetic characters and people who, right, who can kind of like get their arms around these concerns, but also where we can see people of color and women in particular, women of color, who have been the people leading in this space for the past 20 years as characters. Because in the book, you know, as I'm citing so many people, what you can't tell is who these people are unless you know, right? So what many of the people that I'm citing in the book are, you know, LGBTQ, they're people of color, women. So I want to kind of make the people who also have been so impactful in helping us shift these conversations. I want to help make them visible. And if I can do that through these other kind of artistic dissemination of research findings, right? This is how I have to talk about it in university. I think that would be very exciting because I think it would also inspire so many people to see that it's not just like your typical bro Silicon Valley culture that is defining the landscape of what's important. So I could cross your fingers for me, right? I think it would be really amazing. I think people would love it. So we'll see if we get the uptake that we're hoping to get this year.
Yeah. And you know, I can totally see that happening. Okay, let's put it out in the universe right now. That is what we want.
It's happening. Great. Yes. It's happening.
Okay. So, well, thank you again, Sophia, and doing this first thing in the morning with your morning coffee, your morning chit-chat with us.
You're welcome. I really appreciate being here and have a great day.
You too.